I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
From Postcard from the Past and Wardour Studios, this is Podcast from the Past, the Postcard Podcast. This is the podcast where we spend just a little bit of time wondering what it is about little cardboard oblongs that makes them so easy to keep, so hard to throw away, and how that white space beside the address can be filled with clichés, gossip, news, weather reports, poetry, or a mixture of all of the above, as we attempt to understand the memories, meanings, and stories held by picture postcards. I'm Tom Jackson, and today I'm delighted to say that my guests are journalist Rachel Jolly and author Kerry Hudson. Kerry and Rachel, hello and welcome.
Hello. Thank you. Hi.
Now, Rachel Jolly is the award-winning editor of Index on Censorship. She's written and edited for magazines and websites in the UK and internationally. She's currently a visiting fellow in journalism at Sheffield University. Still true?
That's true, yes.
Very good.
Absolutely true.
And she regularly speaks at the world's biggest literature festival at Hay. And she co-wrote the play Murdering the Truth. Now, Rachel comes to us today with a blurry Northampton postmark.
Yes. All my family has grown up in Northampton for, I think, possibly 400 years. So
good
we did
Lord.
A little bit of family tree.
That's amazing to know that.
Looking back at my family tree. And some people, I was a bit jealous, actually, because everybody seems to have exciting relatives who've lived in Australia or Canada or Ireland or Norway. All of my family forever have lived in Northampton. All of them worked in the shoe trade. Cardboard box makers, shoelace makers. Some of them excitingly cut the leather of the shoes. They were the really posh ones.
So do you wear perfectly handmade Northampton shoes all the time?
No, but when I was a child, my dad, who worked in the shoe industry, always shined our shoes on a Sunday night. He was very big on the shiny shoes. That was a sure sign that, you know, he would like you a lot if you had shiny shoes.
It's one way to judge people. Now, Rachel, do you still send postcards?
I do. When I'm on holiday, I do like to send a postcard. So I travel quite often to Italy, and they do a nice little postcard, I think, a sort of seaside postcard. And I do find, I like to write a note back to my mum usually. She loves a postcard. And I do find it quite often, the hardest thing about writing a postcard is finding somewhere that sells the stamp.
Yes.
So I often travel around with them for my 2 weeks holiday with my little bag of postcards thinking, when am I going to find the stamp place?
Oh, no, something to worry about when you're on holiday. You don't want to worry about things on holiday.
And then finally, on the last day, invariably, I'll find the shop that sells the stamps and manage to send them back.
Very good, very good. Now, Kerry Hudson is a novelist. Her first novel, Tony Hogan Bought Me an Ice Cream Float Before He Stole My Ma.
Ridiculous title.
Yeah. Well, you used up all the ink on that. She was the winner. That was the winner of the Scottish First Book Award. Mm-hmm. And her second novel, Thirst, was a highly regarded love story about human trafficking. And that won France's most prestigious award for foreign fiction. Strange to think that was picked up in France for that award.
Yeah, they really loved it there. They said it wasn't a rosewater story. That was what they said. So I think they liked. Well, they didn't want it. They didn't want their love stories like in any way frothy or sentimental or overly emotional. And that is definitely not my shtick. Certainly my writing anyway. So I guess they responded to that.
Well, you've taken that bittersweet style to your new book, which is a memoir, Lowborn, a story of childhood. And a meditation on poverty, really, which has been
extraordinarily well received, and I suppose it's fair to say it's probably been your biggest book so far.
Yeah, for sure. It's been a delight to see it welcomed with such open arms.
It's a wonderful book, very personal, painful, and I feel written with a kind of grace, meaning grace in the elegance of the prose, but also a kind of forgiveness of the trials of the past. It's a very good book as far as I'm concerned. Now, Kerry, as people who've read Lowborn will know, your personal postmark is one of the smudgiest you can have. So tell us briefly, why so smudgy?
As people who've known who've read my first book or Lowborn will know, I was born in Aberdeen to a matriarchal clan of fishwives and fishermen. So I also have that sort of lineage of sort of a family doing one trade all the way down the line. My dad, though, was from LA. So that's already quite Aberdeen and LA is an ungodly mix by anyone's standards.
Boomtowns. Yeah,
exactly. And then part of the narrative bone of backbone of Lowborn is that we moved all the way up and down the country several times. So it's kind of like imagine an envelope with much not at this address, forward onto this address, lots of smudgy postmarks, and lots of stickers on top of stickers with different addresses. That's probably most accurate.
And I suppose the other lesson of Lowborn is that despite that, the piece of correspondence arrives in the end.
It does.
You know, make it through.
Yeah, exactly. You finally get the message in the end.
You can get lost in the post for a while, but you come out the other side. Well, before we discover the cards that Kerry and Rachel have brought along, I've got a couple of mine. These are postcard from the past type cards, like I do on Twitter, a past postcard, from which I've taken an old card and just a bit of the message. So here's one. This is Exeter Cathedral on a lovely sunny day.
Oh, look at that car park.
Look at the car park. Unbelievable. A gothic masterpiece. And what does she say? Look at the car park. Well, they have certainly favoured the car park more than you might, I think.
Yeah, that's why it's interesting, isn't it? And the cars, yes.
Well, actually, when I put some cards on Twitter, it's only the cars that people talk about. They love, oh, is that? And then the argues ensue about the exact model.
And this is my tribe.
1970-something. You can't see. Mid-70s, I think. 4.5p, sent to Grantham in Lincolnshire. And it's just a bit of the message that appealed to me. It's a detail, really. And the correspondent, Marge, says, "Just eaten my dinner. Curry pasty and cream cake."
Healthy.
Pretty good dinner.
Look, that person's my new hero.
Yeah, she's on holiday. That's okay. You're allowed. You're definitely allowed. Another clerical building, another religious building. In fact, it's Exeter Cathedral again.
Oh, cars.
That is a coincidence.
Also, the car park is quite a prominent feature.
Yeah.
The stone has changed colour. And the car park's moved a bit away. But this is a bit later, because now it's sevenpence to send this one. So it's twice the price. And this was sent to Stockton. And this I like because it feels like there's a story resonating off these words. Linda says, "The novelty of being Miss Yardley is beginning to wear off."
Excellent.
That's amazing.
We need to know more about that.
And there's no more to know, even if I read you more. But
can I have that for a novelty?
Some will definitely. Yours, yeah,
it's recorded, though. It's mine.
Usual deal, Kerry.
Do you think the writer was sent along to a beauty pageant and accidentally won the crown and this was sending the message home?
I have a feeling it was something she set her heart on. She really wanted it, and she won it. And, of course, like so many achievements in life, once you've got it, perhaps it's not quite what you wanted or wasn't quite enough.
Imagine the rigours of being Miss Yardley as well. How amazing.
Yeah, well, I mean, Yardley, who are, I'm sure, an excellent company to work for. You know, perhaps in those days they pushed their... What would they call them now?
Beauty pageants.
Spokesmodels.
Yes. Yeah, I think
they push them hard.
Insta influencer, yeah.
Yeah, influencers, exactly. Miss Yardley would have been a proto-influencer. Yeah.
Well, one of my friends was sent along as a reporter to cover the Miss Cromer pageant and ended up winning it.
No.
Yes.
Did she slip a sash on by mistake or something?
I think there was probably not enough competitors and they said, go on. She came back, told the news editor, I won it.
What a great story.
She had to serve as Miss Kramer for a whole year.
Really? Yes. There should be a name for that kind of power dynamic when the wrong person wins who wasn't part of the thing. Because do you remember, you're probably both too young, but there was a TV show called something like Mr. Right or Searching for Mr. Right, and it was about a chap whose name was Wright. I think it's probably Pinchman American format. And they had a dozen women who were vying for his attention. So it was like a sort of dating game, prime time, ITV. And the presenter was Ulrika Johnson. And I'm not saying anything bad. But anyway, the upshot of it was Ulrika Johnson married him. So the presenter married him. I think it's similar. Yes. Like the reporter goes and becomes Miss Cromer.
You have to watch those reporters.
A coup, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Well, they're best placed, don't they? They get to see everything. Special access. So, Kerry, when did you last send a postcard?
Quite recently, actually. So I was recently, only a few weeks ago, in Tbilisi in Georgia, one of my favourite places in the world.
Lovely.
It was during their what people in Armenia were slightly disparagingly calling their mini-revolution, but actually a really amazing moment when all of Tbilisi took to the streets to protest Russian occupation.
Wow.
And so it was a really interesting time to be there. So I sent one. Me and my husband are really, really prolific postcard senders, so he much more so than me, but I will always send one to him because he loves getting one in the post. So
I was saying something the other day, I don't think that feeling ever stops, that it's nice to get stuff in the post, so long as it's nice stuff.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, yeah, it's lovely, isn't it?
Excitement. Especially now. I mean, not enough stuff comes in the post now, so, you know, it's really exciting when something comes through the front door and you hear the noise and you're like, what can that be? And
the dog goes mad.
Yeah. It's actually a postcard that's with some writing. That's great.
Yeah, quick, let's put it on the mantelpiece. Very good. Just to let you know at home, images of all the cards we discussed today are on the blog, postcardfromthepast.co.uk, so you can investigate for yourself. Now, Rachel and Kerry, you've both been kind enough to come along to the studio with a number of postcards. Rachel, let's start with your first one. Now, this is very much tied in with your professional life, isn't
it?
So tell me what you got.
So I have a postcard of the first cover of Index on Censorship magazine. So that was in spring 1972. And we love this postcard so much that we've reproduced it and we send it to people and we give it to people as a gift because there's something so exciting about it for people who work at Index on Censorship. Because
it looks, for some reason, typical of a literary magazine of that era. I don't know, is it to do with that? Because it's the word index in lowercase is written up vertically along one side.
It's very simple, isn't it? And you can sort of imagine them putting it together and you know, shading. I think it probably was letter set, something like that. I mean, the index is always run on a shoestring.
Right.
So it was probably something very simple like that. So it does say something about the era, I think, and probably about how they didn't have very much money. But then on the cover, you've got the names of some amazing authors. So Index was set up by a poet called Stephen Spender, very famous British poet, and he had great contacts around the world. But the reason it was set up, the magazine was set up, was that a set of Russian writers wrote to writers in the UK, and they said, we can't get our work published in what was then the Soviet Union. Please, can you help us get our work published? We need a publication. We don't just need people to campaign and tell others what's going on. We're writers, we want to be published.
Oh, so it's not enough just to say, isn't it dreadful they don't get published?
Yeah.
You might as well provide them that outlet.
We want our writing to be seen and read by people. I'm sure you understand that, Kerry, as a writer.
Strongly relate.
Yeah, and so they decided to, a set of British writers got together and artists, Yehudi Menuhin was involved, and they said they would set up the magazine. And I actually brought a copy, the original copy along as well, just so you guys could have a quick look, and it's on lovely thick paper, but it's got Alexander Solzhenitsyn in it, and he was one of those Russian writers who couldn't have his work published at home.
What stage of his career would he be at then?
And so he, as you know, he was in a labour camp in Russia, and his work was banned and censored, and so for many years his work was being smuggled out to London to be published in Index And the first editor of Index, very luckily, was a Russian translator, Michael Scammell, who had learnt, in the Second World War, he had learnt Russian as part of his wartime work. And so, that turned out to be very handy for all those translations of Russian writers. So it was always about writers around the world, though. It wasn't just about writers in one country. So there are writers from Argentina and there are writers from South Africa and so on. But there's something quite exciting about, I think, about the image of the very first issue and actually having the issue itself. So you can
Who else is in there in that one, the first one?
So, the ones you probably will know is Stephen Spender, Alexander Solzhenitsyn. There's George Seferis, Jose Cardoso Perez, Jennifer Coates writing about Bangladesh. But it was interesting because I started flicking through and looking at some of the things about that we were writing at the time, and it seemed so current.
Right.
You know, they were saying, it's about borders going up and down, it's about police and it's about security, it's about how we get our words out. And I thought, doesn't that feel familiar? But you know, there's something, it touches on, I think, a bit of literary history, but also about the key issue that we deal with all the time, which is about journalists and writers being censored. And you get a kind of sense of the works being smuggled out across borders. So there's something about that. I think all of that I get from the postcard.
And the kind of nuts and bolts of getting stuff out. That must have changed now, the digital world.
Yes. So a lot of, in the beginning, it was often passed hand to hand in envelopes and across borders. And
wow.
Robert McCrum, who has been a big friend of Index over the years and was the former literary editor of The Observer, told me a story about how he went into Prague with a bag of bananas and then he exchanged the bananas for some text and then, when it was still communist and took bananas were in short supply. So that was, something useful
to
have.
A three-volume novel for some bananas.
Yeah, and it was also quite good for bribing guards and things, I think, you know. And, so often envelopes and passed hand to hand and so on. Although we're starting to think that might be a good idea again, you know, because all of that digital stuff, it's getting more and more difficult to get email, everyone can see email.
Do you think it's too vulnerable?
It's too, yeah. And so there's been a lot of talk about how actually going back to paper. One of the journalists I know says he's not reading electronic books anymore. He's only reading books on paper because he doesn't want other people to know what he's reading. And, he's in a country...
Well, I'm the same, but it's because I don't want to drop the book in the bath.
He's more worried about what the state might be watching. You know, so it is... We've gone one way, but I think, in a sense, there might be a sense that we're going back to paper in some ways. It has certain levels of security that digital doesn't.
Would you ever reissue those? It would be fascinating to see how people respond to it now.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly something...
Or selected, perhaps.
Yes. It's something that we're thinking about. And we do have a complete archive in the Bishopsgate Institute in London, so it's open to the public and free, so people could go and see the issues.
One question that kind of strikes me is sort of typical of our time. Obviously, freedom of speech is kind of a banner for you. That's a phrase and a kind of ideology that gets kind of hijacked quite a lot at the moment as an excuse for hate speech and so on. How do you deal with the way that particular area has got a bit kind of hijacked and reused?
I think you have to take it to basic principles, which is that free speech is about everyone's right to say things, and those things you might find offensive or concerning or worrying, and you have to be prepared that people will say things that you might not like and you might disagree with strongly, and those things should be allowed, and that is something that is a principle that we find a lot of people don't seem to feel strongly about at the moment. That there is this kind of bubble society where a lot of people don't often meet people who they disagree with.
The echo chamber, and
find it difficult to be in a room or in a discussion with people that they disagree with. So there is this thing about what is hate speech and what is incitement and what is, you know, what is offensive. And I think we have to be very careful with all of those things because they are very loosely used often.
They're
used in a sense of, I don't like what you're saying, yeah, or I disagree strongly with what you're saying. And that's a whole different thing from, say, incitement to violence, which is obviously where we would absolutely draw the line, or, you know, I think we have to be careful that that space in the middle, where it's actually about people having different views or strongly held beliefs that you might strongly disagree with, but you have to be prepared to hear them, because if you're not prepared to hear their views, they're not prepared to hear your views, then what kind of society are we going to live in? And are we just going to turn off everybody? And so we end up with a world of silence. I mean, that I think people don't think about the consequences as much as they should.
It's interesting, walking those tightropes. You know, you're at, cliche upon cliche, but you're at the cutting edge of that, having to sort of, to some extent, track those changes in the way people see the world and what people are and aren't prepared to listen to.
Absolutely, and I think you quite often have to fight for people that you personally might really strongly disagree with their views, but you have to believe that in their right to have them and their right to be allowed to say them.
Yes, well, you know, we all have to live in the same place, so your neighbours may be obnoxious, but they have a right to live there and, you know, even mow their lawn on a Sunday morning. It's the way it is. It's the way it is.
Straight to the serious issues.
Exactly. So, Kerry, you brought far too many cards with you, but what's the first lump you've got for us?
So the first lump is actually postcards between me and my husband. I feel this is, like, so frivolous and sentimental after your beautiful talk about censorship and freedom of speech. Me and my husband only met each other 5 years ago now, so not that long ago, and we were friends for a long time. And then when he went to France to visit his mum in a tiny little village in France called Blenny-sur-Ouche, he sent me a postcard that was a beautifully drawn map of the village, but when you turned it a certain way, it was a perfect diagram of a giant cock.
By chance?
No, by deliberate.
You're joking.
So he spent ages, it was coloured in, there were felt tips, and I was like, oh, this guy's pretty special.
This is the man
exactly
that I love.
Exactly. And somebody else was like, he definitely likes you. If he drew you a giant cock on a postcard, then he really likes you. Am I allowed to say cock this many times in the podcast?
I think you have.
Is it a first? Okay, it just happens.
We'll be putting the little E explicit. That's fine.
Never had a podcast without one.
Can I just say, I really like those draw yourself postcards. You know, I have actually got a book of empty postcards, the ones that you can just draw your own, you know, image on them. I think they're great.
Yeah. It was just like a really lovely thing. And then when we finally got together, he has an enormous collection, probably not to rival yours, but
mine's a hoard, so his is probably a collection.
So we spent like an afternoon just sitting in his room reading through them, and things that he found, like charming and funny about them and sweet, I also did. And so really, like, our love affair sort of happened over it.
Then you're in the right place. This is great.
Exactly. So this is one from him from Geneva. He's Swiss. His family are Swiss. And he's written some... I asked him, I'll read it. I don't think you can decide if you want to put it in. My absolute beloved, I found an affordable and very cute cafe near the station. It's Geneva, so everything costs £20.
Oh, yeah.
It's so nice to be in a new place again, but still not as good as that garage forecourt, or even better, were I here with you. You are my most favourite person in all the world, and I adore you. Kiss. And then he's done like little pictures. And so postcards have kind of become this like lovely love letter between us, I guess.
Isn't that brilliant that you can put that on a postcard? And that's not a secret message. I can feel it from here.
Yeah.
It's powerful stuff.
It's quite a small studio. Maybe you can feel it too much, perhaps, actually.
That's really sweet.
No,
and he didn't mind the postman seeing
that. That's what I was thinking.
He doesn't. I mean, he did say to me, I said, I'm going to read these out with this podcast. He said, oh, God, do I not have any privacy? And I was like, you're literally married to a memoir. Like,
yes.
On earth were you expecting?
Check out my CV.
Exactly.
Into my next book also.
People keep recognising him from the book now.
Oh, really?
And getting all misty-eyed and sentimental.
Well, you do speak very, very highly of him in the book.
He's a very delightful man and tall. And the other one is from me, from Tbilisi, just also basically talking about how much I love him. It's not a super good story, but it is a very simple one.
It's interesting that you are doing that on postcards, because not everyone is. Postcards are not always used like that these days.
No, and I think often they're very brief. Hello, I'm here, I'm in this place. See you soon, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, they're quite sort of schematic. Yeah. But also, you know, as someone who's interested in the old postcards, people used to, in the early days, the golden age, they call it, sort of before the First World War, they would write a lot of very sort of emotional and romantic messages on postcards. They were used because there weren't many. You couldn't do it any other way, really, except in person. And often people say things a little bit in code or whatever.
Yeah.
But there was a way of people keeping in touch and expressing their feelings. So I think it's a long and noble tradition.
Well, it's lovely. And it's lovely to have these as well. You know, like we travelled all the way around the world a few years ago. We've moved like 5 times just since we've been together. But we always have these. And they're like this lovely like sort of place marker of where a relationship is and where we've been together and when we've been missing each other. So,
well, they're not too big as souvenirs. This is the thing. You know,
yes,
you can keep quite a lot of postcards before you fill your garage and can't get in it.
I love the idea of the I've heard about but never used the post restaurant. Is that what it's called?
Oh, I don't even really know what that is.
How is it pronounced?
I think it's post. I've never used it either. I looked into it. I mean, you don't really need to now. You've got email and things.
No, not but basically.
But you could stay somewhere.
If you were going on a world trip, It'd be quite useful for you, wouldn't it, on your world trip, on your book tour or something. You've got your post sent to the post office
to
any post office around the world, and then you would go into the post office, and all your post would be there.
Yes,
wouldn't that be lovely?
It'd be like being in a Graham Greene novel or something.
Yeah. Yes,
you could send your postcards to your husband wherever he was around the world, and then when he was in Sicily or whatever, he'd just pop into Palermo post office, pick up his postcards.
By the time he gets there, they're practically bindable.
added layer of like sentimentality, I think, to then go and collect them.
Yes. Fourth day, I've come to... No, still not here. Well, normally at this stage, I would do another one of my amusing cards, but actually, with you in mind, Kerry... I know that one of the towns in your book is Great Yarmouth.
Yes, in Great Yarmouth. And sunny Great Yarmouth.
What exactly? I was digging through some old cards I had at Great Yarmouth, and I thought I'd share them with you. Now, these are from 1906, so there's no danger of bumping into anyone.
Oh, my God.
So
do you know
how much of that is still there?
Well, the winter gardens are now this enormous... So that this is a picture of Britannia Pier. And the winter gardens, which is like the big sort of glass structure, is now the most Las Vegas-y casino, like arcade you can ever imagine.
Oh, really?
I write about it in the book, actually. It's like just being assaulted from all sides by all your senses. but a lot of it's... I worked on this pier, actually.
Did you?
Yeah, I did. I worked on the stall where you throw darts to get teddy bears. But I didn't totally understand how it worked. So everyone got a teddy bear that day. Is everyone winning? And I was like, yeah, I don't know. They're just all winning. So I did not last long there. But Great Yarmouth, I think, has so many charms. It's just a real shame that it never really caught up to these glory days, I think, you know.
I worked on the Great Yarmouth Mercury as a reporter.
Did you?
Did you?
So is that where you started out?
Yeah. Oh my God, I'm so starstruck.
Very exciting job. And we used to, you know, be able to interview all the stars on the pier, like, you know, Jim Davidson or whoever
he
came
had
by.
The theatre for a while, didn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, and he would be there a lot and go to the circus. Is the circus still there?
The circus is. As someone told me in Norwich at a literary festival recently, still world class.
It's just amazing.
It's really
building.
Impressive. And they've
really
got they've got a water show now. It's really impressive.
Yeah.
When were you at the Mercury?
Oh, long time ago, more than 20 years now.
We'd been there at the same time.
Yeah. So
I wonder if you ever covered
not this long ago. I just put that out.
No.
I did do some theatre reviewing at the Yarmouth Theatre, but yeah, it was I just went to see that film yesterday, and Yarmouth, I think, is in there.
Oh,
it's all in
I think it's shot over there, isn't it?
Yeah,
yes.
It's all in the East Anglia coast, and I work for the Eastern Daily Press. We covered it all over East Anglia, so I'm like, oh, there, and oh, yes, and that's I recommend, you know, and I go there, and I know where it all is. So
now,
it's lovely.
Here's another one of Great Yarmouth. Now, this one I didn't really understand, but I think you might understand better.
It's the herring, the Scottish lassies at work, Great Yarmouth. This is astounding. Because it's the herring woman. Yeah, so
and
the women
Scottish.
Who travelled.
They were
from Aberdeen. Yeah. So one of the things that I say in the book is that I travelled.
You took the route.
We took the route down the coast. The
and that
same
made
way,
me think of this.
They call it chasing silver darlings. That's what they'd say. So they'd follow the herring
phrase.
All the way down.
For grim work.
Yeah. awful, like backbreaking, brutal, rough work. But that's why the women who emerged from it were like, you know, brick shit houses
with
loads of attitude. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, they were astounding women. What an incredible card!
It's funny, isn't it? And then,
and
they call them Scotch lassies.
Yeah. A wee Scotch lassie. Yeah,
sort of affectionate or diminutive or whatever. But it's
I'd love to see those women in Great Yarmouth and how that all works. I would love to go back and be like
back in time.
They would have travelled from Scotland, or were they living in Yarmouth?
I think they came every year, didn't they?
They travelled down, so
they
literally
work.
Yeah, seasonal work,
okay,
and they
like
just followed
in Kent or something.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And they just followed the route down,
right.
And then they do their work, and then they go back to Scotland.
And they were considered colourful enough to have a postcard done of them to sell to tourists.
Yeah, I've never seen that before, ever. It's amazing.
And Yarmouth still has a big connection with Scotland through the oil and the gas and that industry, I think. So the Aberdeen link's still there.
Occasionally, I mean, I feel like whenever I meet anyone Scottish, they're like, oh, do you know Davy from down the shop? And I'll be like, no, I don't, because Scotland's quite big. But there is like a sort of automatic kinship with Scottish people, which I love. Do you know what I mean? Like, you're automatically best pals with whatever Scot you meet. So I did meet quite a lot of Scottish people, and also, I mean, a lot of my family went there really because they were kind of itinerant, and it's a seaside town, so there's seasonal work and there's accommodation, and that's a really important that was a really important thing for us. So
hiring for your small business, if you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
You're listening to Podcasts from the Past, the Postcard Podcast. My guests today are Kerry Hudson and Rachel Jolly. Now, Rachel, what's the second card you've got for us today?
I'm, like, the serious one today. I'm feeling like...
Well, you say you're serious. There's a cartoon in your hand.
I know, but cartoons can be serious,
true enough.
And so I bought this one because we work a lot with cartoonists, and they work for the magazine, and we work with them when they end up being censored by or put in prison and all these kind of things that happen to cartoonists in different parts of the world. And we commissioned a series of postcards that were themed around free speech from cartoonists around the world. And this was quite a quirky one. I quite like this one because it's got a woman having a cup of coffee, reading a newspaper, and then you've got this huge sort of surveillance eye over the top of her looking down.
Eyeballs, doesn't it?
Three eyeballs, in fact, looking down and reading the newspaper over her shoulder. And I thought, well, that feels just like all these things that are in the newspapers this morning, all the stuff about more and more surveillance. And this isn't this year's postcard, so it was a few years ago, but I think it's really caught something about how we worry about who's watching us and when they're watching us and what information is being captured, and you know, some of the stuff that's coming on in China at the moment about facial recognition and CCTV everywhere, and how that's being used to stop people, particularly the Uyghur Muslims in parts of China, from travelling around. Anyway, I felt like this cartoon, in a quirky way, captured some of that idea, really, some of those kind of important messages around censorship and free expression and surveillance.
Cartoonists often find themselves at the sharp end of the issues around censorship, don't they? Because they're, I suppose, because they're trying to catch the moment.
Yeah, and they're pushing the boundaries. Yeah. And as we've seen with some of the news coverage recently, some newspapers are edging away from cartoonists because they're worried about that. They're worried about the flack that they get for that. Some, they have to be outrageous, don't they? A lot of cartoonists are, you know, caricaturing some of the leading politicians, and not all of the politicians like that. So I think in this country, actually, quite a lot of politicians quite like those caricatures, I've been told.
Typically.
With the spitting image puppets of yesteryear, that actually the politicians that were caricatured in spitting image, they quite liked it. But
do you think British political cartoons are as savage these days? I'm not sure they are as savage as they have been.
Some of Martin Rowson's are pretty savage,
that's
I would
true.
Say,
yes,
in The Guardian.
Yes.
And, so, as you say, cartoonists do get locked up. We work with a Malaysian cartoonist called Zunar, who's been imprisoned, and some Turkish cartoonists like Mirza Kart. And
when you say you work with them, what do you do?
Well, Zuno was actually an award winner of ours, and we help him travel around the world sometimes. He came over recently for our awards. We ran campaigns around what was happening to him in terms of charges against him, and doing press work to raise the profile of what was happening, some coverage of what is going on, you know, in different countries in the world around cartoonists. And also we commission cartoonists because, of course, they need money to carry on, don't they? So it's important that they're, from the beginning, we were talking about people needing their work to be out there. I've just commissioned 3 cartoonists from different countries in the world where cartoonists often, what they find is their work's turned off. They can't get any more work because their work is very controversial. And if they live in a country where the state's very authoritarian, they might lean on places, don't commission this guy. We don't want you to put his work in the paper anymore.
Cartoons in some ways are perfectly suited to sort of digital dissemination. Mm. On a completely different model in a way from you know regular newspapers and so on, because you do find it tends to be rather sentimental cartoons, but when something awful happens in the world, someone will put out a cartoon that somehow sums it up in whatever way, and as I say, often a rather sentimental take on it, but it becomes absolutely viral, doesn't it? And that can happen. So cartoons maybe they'll find a kind of new platform. They seem well suited to that square of light on your phone.
Apparently Instagram cartoons do very well on Instagram.
Oh, do they?
Yeah.
Oh, of course.
So,
that would be perfect.
So
if I understood Instagram better, I would know that.
A lot of young people like looking at cartoons, and apparently The New Yorker is doing a really interesting thing where it puts a lot of its cartoons out on Instagram and in the hope that it will bring it new audience. Whether the cartoonists will find a financial model that makes that work, I don't know. Because,
yeah.
Of course, that's about having your work out there for free, potentially.
Yes.
But and would that work, say, somewhere like China? Would it work
where they
have massive controls over
absolutely.
Social media?
That's. I think it's often about finding new ways of putting information across. Sometimes using social media or different types of new media can mean that you get round restrictions because the authorities haven't quite caught up with it yet.
It's more nimble than the state.
For instance, with podcasts, this is a way that people are getting round news restrictions in certain countries.
Well, that's my attempt, is to get when the postcard police come knocking, we're sorted, we've got the podcast, so we're okay.
Good.
Well, that's very good. Thank you for sharing that and those thoughts about cartoonists and free speech. Kerry, the next lump of cards that you brought. Now, these are cards that you have collected.
I collect them, yes. So I should say I'm not normally as sentimental and mushy as this, but I have spent all year so far talking about childhood trauma and poverty.
Perhaps
so
you
it's
need it now.
Quite nice to have a little break, to be honest. So these are...
This could be a companion piece to your book.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is... I started travelling 15 years ago, and so I'd come home for about 6 or 8 months and then go away somewhere, so either Europe or South America. Spent a lot of time in Southeast Asia.
And this was fun. or fun combined with literary tasks?
Fun at first, and then it got less fun. No, oh. It was fun at first, and then I started writing. So I realised that actually it was a really good way to balance the financial sort of difficulties of writing. If I could save up some money, go away somewhere, spend some time writing, and then I went away with my husband, and we travelled around the world for a while then as well. And everywhere I've gone, I've collected. Everywhere there's a flea market, and I've collected postcards of people's weddings. So
brilliant idea. Brilliant.
Would you know what's kind of sad is that I should have, and I haven't. I haven't. Oh, this one's got something on the back of it. Is that, what's that? Is that German or? No, that's Turkish, isn't it?
It looks like Turkish. Yeah.
Yeah, so this is a Turkish wedding. Absolutely. Yeah, it's Turkish, yeah. It's just, I mean, basically, they're usually just sort of set shots, but they tell you so much about the culture and the people. And I'm always, there's one that I've got of an East End wedding where everyone's got pies and beans.
Wow.
I couldn't find it. And the husband looks totally delighted and the wife is already like, what the hell have I done? And you can just see it written all over her face, and then it's immortalised forever.
I never signed up
forever.
For pies and beans.
And I just find them fascinating. You know, there's so many subtle little indicators, so many little stories. It's also this like really important day in people's lives where everything changes. So you're capturing this perfect
and
moment.
And these are what they call real photographics. They're real photographs which were then printed up with a postcard backing to them.
Yeah.
So they could easily just be wedding photographs, but because they've got that back, they count. They jump into
just
the category.
Just about. I mean, yeah. I squeezed it in. I tried to put these up on an old wall of mine, and my ex-partner said she thought it was really macabre because they must be dead. But I think it's wonderful.
That's true of all old stuff, though,
exactly.
Isn't it?
Exactly. I like a bit of sentimental macabre.
And
I don't
also,
mind.
It's a history, isn't it? It's a tracing of the history through weddings. As you say, a really special day. Quite often, it was the only day of the year that people had off work, isn't it? So I remember covering golden weddings, talking to people in there when they were 60, when I was, you know, starting off as a reporter, and they'd say they got married on Christmas Day, and I thought, what a strange day to get married. And they were like, yeah, that's the only day off work we had.
Yes.
So we got married on Christmas Day. And I realised after a while, everyone got married on Christmas Day because that was their day off.
Oh, God. I've got to say, I spent a lot of this trying to work out like how they afforded everything. Like the East End wedding, you can see, is kind of cobbled together. The bride's dress doesn't quite fit, you know, like...
Do you use a magnifying glass to go right into the detail?
I mean, no, I wish I had a magnifying glass because that's just
know.
A lovely affectation for a writer, isn't it? But no, I mean, I just I kind of use them as story triggers, but mainly I just think how lovely to, especially because, you know, I don't have a lot of family photos myself because we moved around so much, how lovely to have all these little pieces of history and make your own, really. Yeah.
But there is a melancholy to them because they're with you, and although they're interesting to you, they don't have any true meaning to you. And the person who they would have had true meaning to is separated from them.
There's nothing sadder, right, than going to a flea market and seeing a box of someone's correspondence. Like, as nosy as I am, I'm a writer, like, of course, I'm, like, the most vicarious, voyeuristic person in the world. But there's something heartbreaking about seeing someone's photos and correspondence just laid out for someone to buy for a few p, yeah. Mm.
But at least they're not getting trodden into a puddle. You are keeping hold of them.
Yeah,
you're treasuring them.
Yeah, I treasure them, yeah. So I'll keep collecting them, and then one day maybe I'll do something interesting with them.
Yeah, no, I think it's a brilliant idea. Really brilliant. Thank you both so much for your time and your postcards. I'm thrilled that you shared them with me and with the listeners. Another quick reminder, images of all these cards, from the cartoon to the index to the weddings, they're all going to be on the blog, postcardfromthepast.co.uk, so you can have a look at it and see that we weren't making it up. And including actually one last one from me in the past postcard style, which you're probably familiar with from Twitter and so on. This is a card, rather amazing colours actually. It's a John Hind card, good publisher, English publisher. Very oversaturated colours. It's almost like The Wizard of Oz or something, the colours.
Can I ask? My husband said that there's... My husband said that there's... Welcome to the 1950s. He said that there's... That postcards often use a lot of red because it's like a visually like pleasing colour.
Particularly John Hind would very often have someone in red, yes. And in fact, in this case, it's kind of well placed. It's the rider on the horse. But often they'll put a little boy in a red jumper in the foreground or something to kind of make, I guess it pops out against the predominantly green background. Mm. But yeah, people on Twitter are rather big fans of always spotting the red person in red and so on. So no, absolutely right, absolutely right. And it does. And it, I don't know what plant that is. Is that like a sort of foxglove or something? Sort of pinky purple.
Yes,
very
I think,
bright.
Yeah, I think just, right.
It's doing the work as well as the rider.
It jumps out at you, doesn't it, in rather a scary way.
Yeah, no, they are amazing cars. They're some of the most beautifully photographed there are. This is from 1988, actually, which seems like 5 minutes ago to me. And it was sent by a woman called Christine, and it was sent to Sevenoaks in Kent. And some stories don't really need any further elaboration. I don't think this does. Geoffrey fell out of his top bunk and broke his wrist on Monday night.
Oh, poor Geoffrey.
That's the highlight of the holiday.
Yeah, that the subtext of that is Geoffrey ruined her holiday, right? I mean, that's...
Oh, I just thought, it's just what Geoffrey would do. It's Geoffrey
typical,
all
classic Geoffrey.
Yeah, I said to put him in the bottom bunk. But no, Geoffrey fell out of the top bunk. Of course he did. Well, before we let Rachel and Kerry back to their real lives, I've got one more postcard for you both, which it is customary to end the programme with one of these. So I know you have fond memories of Paris, Kerry.
Good Lord. I do indeed,
I think
yes.
I'm right in saying that
no,
it's
you
Paris.
Are, yeah.
I don't know if you've seen one of these before.
What happens here?
Oh. You play it and it plays a song. It's a, is it a record postcard?
That is exactly right.
Sweet Jesus, that's amazing.
That's
oh
the
my
best
God.
Response we've had.
Phonoscope.
No, that's incredible. You know can that? I play this? I've got a record player at home.
Well,
that's too little,
if
though.
We ask young Tom nicely, he might be able to use the technology that he has.
Wow. Tom? That's amazing.
Yeah, Rocky Roll.
Is it from the Moulin Rouge? Is that the idea? It's the music of the Moulin
I think
Moulin Rouge.
The picture rarely relates to the music.
Okay. That's asking too much.
It's kind of early swinging 60s, I think, in Paris.
Oh, it's fabulous.
Hey, Mambo.
Amazing.
You didn't hear this when you were in Paris?
I mean, no. But the loss is all mine. Yeah. Cake shops play a lot less music than you'd expect, and that's where I spend most of my time, so...
Well, I always say the same thing. Not bad for a piece of cardboard.
Incredible.
It's really good quality.
I've never heard of them before.
No. I was really impressed how you guessed what it was.
Eagle eyes. Well, as the Moulin Rouge continues to spin at 45 RPM and never stops, that's it for this time on Podcast from the Past. I'd very much like to thank my first-class guests for sharing the postcards from their pasts, Rachel Jolly and Kerry Hudson. Thank you both.
Thank you so much. Thanks.
And thank you for listening. Bye for now. You can see more postcards with their messages posted every day on Twitter. Do follow me at @PastPostcard. And you can buy the book, Postcard from the Past, by me, Tom Jackson, at Amazon and all good booksellers. And if you're looking for podcast production, check out wardourstudios.co.uk.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.